This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman for a suite of professional-grade products from Protocol for Life Balance, which play a central role in helping support optimal immune function. Micell Immune Plus, Vitamin C 1000 plus Zinc 15, and Vitamin D3 in a variety of potencies and delivery systems, liquid, chewable, and soft gels. They're only available from healthcare practitioners, but they're available to you at drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information and to order. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest is Dr. Robert Verkerk. He is the founder, scientific director of the Alliance for Natural Health, ANH, which is the international version of ANH. There's one stateside as well, of which he is part. But what does ANH do, basically, Rob?
Well, in summary, what we do is we safeguard and promote natural and sustainable healthcare. So we really fundamentally come from a place where we believe that good health is achieved by working with nature rather than against it. And we through a combination of campaigns, activism, research, and education, we help effectively create a better lot for natural health from looking at the legal side of it, the scientific side of it, and do an awful lot of education and support for practitioners, doctors, the community. We lobby governments and generally are passionate about anything to do with natural health.
Indeed. And so when it comes to COVID-19, you know, I was intrigued, and perhaps you follow this. There was congressional testimony last week where there was a showdown of sorts between Dr. Anthony Fauci and Senator Rand Paul on the subject of herd immunity. And Dr. Fauci rather impatiently schooled Rand Paul, who, by the way, is a physician. You know, he said, yep. Senator, you may be the only person who believes that a 22% rate of positivity constitutes herd immunity. He was specifically referring to the rather high rate of positivity where I live here in New York City. And Rand Paul tried to explain in kind of a nuanced fashion that classic herd immunity may not be really applicable to this current pandemic. And, you know, I thought that Fauci was being kind of dismissive and simplistic in putting Rand Paul down.
Look, I would 100% agree. The reality is that anyone who says they know exactly how herd immunity is going to operate with a new disease is really not talking a whole lot of sense, and I could be more rude than that. We know, for example, that, you know, common cold, around about 15% or so common cold is caused by a coronavirus, and we know that it can be held in check with levels of herd immunity as low as 20%. The additional problems come from how are we going to measure immunity in the population. And one of the problems that we've got is there's been more work done on the what we know as the humoral side of the adaptive immune system, the antibody protection side, and there's been less work done on the cell-mediated or T-cell response.
Right. Because we can measure the B-cell or the humoral response. That's the so-called antibody test. But it's kind of hard to put your finger on T-cell immunity, and there have been several papers on that.
Exactly. What we know is that the antibody response is not, particularly for coronaviruses, we know this, the antibody response is not very long-lived. And the T-cell response, the thing that allows you to have, say, a vaccine that might give you a lifetime protection, or have a disease that gives you a lifetime protection, that's derived from these very, very clever memory T cells that develop a memory for the disease and then basically mark and go after them, and bingo, you have many years of protection. And it's interesting that a lot of the emphasis, partially because it's been easier, but if I wanted to be a little bit more sinister, I might say because if you focus on antibody, humoral immunity, you are going to have a much stronger ability to say, guys, 12 months has gone past, it's time for you to have your repeat COVID vaccine, and why don't we mix them together with your winter flu shot as well?
So the other issue that has been brought up in relation to herd immunity is that, you know, we tend to use a kind of a like a mechanistic model of like, you know, it's as if we were throwing a like a color packet of dye into an aquarium and we want to watch to see how fast the dye disperses in an aquarium. But a human population is not like, you know, an aquarium. There are pockets of people who sequester, who take very little risk, and then there's some people who are at high risk, and the dispersal rate in a human population is it's kind of complicated. So applying just a mathematical model of herd immunity to a situation like that, especially now with, you know, a great deal of social distancing and masking and so on, that's not going to be very accurate, is it?
Absolutely not. You're spot on with that. The idea that you'll find that most of the, you know, Gavi and, you know, people like obviously Fauci and Bill Gates, who's putting a lot of money into this, will keep on citing figures that are in the order of 70%.
Yeah, that you have to have 70% of the people infected, which would be catastrophic. Yeah. We don't want to just let her rip and you know, expose so many people to the virus, because we'll have more deaths.
But when you look behind those figures and look for the hard data, they're really pretty limited. There isn't good science. I think that comes from putting together a lot of vaccine studies where there is confounding, certainly epidemiologically, about what's happening in the real world. And you'll find that very often there was already a range of other factors that was influencing the progression of this, you know, of the disease in question, even with something as obvious as measles, which is often picked up as the
which is very contagious. It's much more contagious than COVID-19. I mean, it's like,
exactly.
Yeah,
it has an R value of about 15 as against sort of 1.3 or something. So massively more contagious. But even then, it's the data are quite weak to take those data and say, well, this is the degree of herd immunity, and then to suggest that vaccine coverage, you know, if you vaccinate 70% of the people, you're also assuming that you've got 100% effectiveness. And as we know with flu vaccines, mm-hmm. most of the data is pointing to perhaps a figure close to 40%.
Right.
So there's a lot of mixing and matching of data. I think those figures like 70% are really picked from the air, and they kind of work quite well if you have a national immunization program. Moving to what's happening in countries, you mentioned the Scandinavian situation. We've got a very interesting situation if you look, say, at three Scandinavian or four Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark,
with
and
differing
Finland.
Approaches.
All very different approaches. One of the things we're really learning in Europe about what's going on is it seems remarkable how little effect government policy right. on things like lockdown has. This thing is moving through the community, whatever.
Yeah.
And yes, you can probably slightly slow the pain and extend the period when the pain from collateral damage becomes more of a problem. Mm-hmm. But the thing is going to move through the community. So on the Swedish example, obviously Sweden, because it didn't play the game and had, if you like, what we can summarize as light lockdown, it was in the naughty corner, particularly when the mm-hmm. mortality rates were sitting roughly the same level as Italy or Spain or the UK or Belgium. These are amongst the countries in Europe that had the highest mortality. Mm-hmm. And of course, in all of those examples, you can trace that mortality to situations in which shielding of vulnerable populations, particularly in care homes, was not managed well. And Anders Tegnell, the epidemiologist who's heading up the Swedish program, put his hand up and said, guys, we could have done better. And that was a sad loss of life. Now, what's really interesting about what's happening now, incidentally, Norway and Finland, they didn't have the same number of starter cases. so that, you know, if you didn't seed the population mm-hmm. with SARS coronavirus 2 to the same extent early on, because you didn't have as much international travel from right. Italy or China or whatever, you start with a much lower starting point. And that seems to have been one of the problems with Sweden. So it got going much more rapidly. What's really interesting now is that the Swedish levels are very stable. They are, if you look at the upswing in cases, yeah. and bearing in mind all the stuff we talked about in the first segment, with cases going up because the testing frequency is going up. You test more people and you only look at cases. Obviously, it'll go up, which is why you need to be looking at positivity rate.
Right.
What is the percentage of the people who are tested that are positive?
Right.
You'll see that there is extreme stability. And if anything, things are moving in the right way. Now, there are a couple of studies that have been done that shows that even though the level of antibody immunity is probably, relatively low still, the T cell immunity might mm-hmm. be up around mm-hmm. 20% or so. And that may well be because we know that's right. the kind of level. This is coming back to the point that Rand Paul made, and it's where he's getting his data from. It may be, there's still a question mark over it, but it may be that already around Stockholm, where people are collected, the levels are higher than that, and actually it's providing some natural
herd. It somewhat
immunity.
Vindicates the herd immunity theory. And, you know, look, you know, when we try to control traffic, you know, we don't erect steel walls. We put in speed bumps, and speed bumps don't prevent cars from moving through areas, but they do slow the traffic. And it's possible that an aggregate number of cases in the teens or 20s percentages is kind of offering a speed bump to the progression of the virus. It's not binary. It's not 100%. But that may be what's happening, because I'm here in New York, and you know, we got slammed with this here in New York, and now things are relatively benign, except for a few hot spots. Our case rate is very low.
Exactly. Well, you know, the bottom line is that we've had over 200 mutations already in the virus. We also have a number of different strains that are found in different parts, and we're beginning to understand something about the fact that these behave differently. But the normality, if you look back at what happens when any virus finds a new host, is that it's always going to be a noisy relationship early on while we adjust to it. And it, you know, the virulence effectively reduces. Now, that certainly happened. I mean, what happened?
Yeah, there's a word for it. It's viral attenuation. Viruses tend to attenuate. They don't generally get worse. They get a little weaker. They become sometimes more transmissible. But their goal is not to kill people. It's simply to survive and propagate. And a milder infection may be more insidious and may enable the virus to, you know, do its thing.
Absolutely. And that we may already be reaching that point, which is why if you base your policies on cases, you are likely to induce enormous amount of collateral damage. What's very interesting in the Swedish example is that Sweden is the only country in Europe that has actually suffered no economic negative consequences.
And which is important.
One of the things that's misunderstood internationally about Sweden is that while they had no laws enforcing lockdown, they had guidance. And I think one of the important things to recognize about the Swedish people is that's how they always go about doing public health. They are also very, very responsive to the requests of the government. So a lot of people did self-isolate. Mm-hmm. A lot of people did stay at home if they felt they're vulnerable.
It's a disciplined population. They're not flaunting things generally.
But they didn't shut down. They didn't force the shutdown of businesses. What they did was increase their export to other parts of Europe. So even though they saw a change in the sectors that were economically active through the period when the rest of Europe was locked down, they actually increased their exports. They had no net impact on GDP. And that, I think is that is at the center of the problem that we face now. If you focus all of your energy into a disease and then latterly the cases, the presence of the gene sequences relating to a particular virus, and you don't consider what the collateral effects of that in terms of job losses, social impacts, education, you know, when we understand that social determinants of health are the single most important determinants, what we create is a situation where we create more health inequalities, things that we've been trying to, you know, narrow for decades. Within the space of less than a year, that divide has been broken wide open, and we've got to start understanding the consequences of these policies. So I totally understand the growing and support the growing body of people and scientists and others who say the response by and large has been disproportionate, and we need to get back to life as usual and get on with it.
Indeed. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this vital information with you. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Healthy Aging, providing you with the unique energy support of Pure NT Factor. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years with a 45-day money-back guarantee of nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158. That's 800-982-9158. Or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. Robert Furkirk. Let's spend a few moments in the remaining time talking about the prospects for a vaccine. You know, here in the United States, we have something called Operation Warp Speed to develop new therapies and rush a vaccine into production. President Trump says that the military is ready to distribute hundreds of millions of doses of the vaccine at a moment's notice as soon as the vaccine is approved sometime this fall. What are the prospects for that?
Well, the bottom line is we've got to recognize a coronavirus vaccine for humans has never been created before. On top of that, we are using vaccine platforms that have never been used at scale. We have a huge array of problems that require, for example, minus 80 degree, you know, transport throughout the entire vaccine supply chain, which is going to
good
be
luck.
Difficult.
I can't even get a frozen pizza, you know, that's been cooled to the proper temperature. You know, my ice cream is, you know, is glacial by the time I receive it because it's been sitting out on a pallet for too long.
There you go. So you know, there are many ifs and buts in terms of this idea. I think it's a promise that's being oversold to the people. It could happen. That it does work, and I really understand why there's some energy going into there. But making it the exclusive option, I believe, is deeply dangerous for society. And what we're suggesting is that given the extreme polarization, and really, unfortunately, what has happened is that now if anyone chooses to question the logic of going all out into a vaccine solution to COVID-19, they're immediately compartmentalized as a conspiracy theorist. That is bad for science. It's bad for public health. It's bad for all of us, you know, out there in communities. It's bad for doctors who decided to you know, raise the question of what's happening. And we believe that a new narrative is needed, and that narrative should be based around transparency. You know, we're not saying pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine, but guys, there's a number of things that everyone needs. This is for the common good. The public is largely funding this. Mm-hmm. The public is taking a huge risk over whether it happens. And what we need to have is full disclosure of raw data from studies. We need to have all the data published, you know, the safety and efficacy trials that already have emerged, phase one and two, you'll find that there's a huge amount of data that's not being declared. Mm. We need to know exactly what's in the vaccines, you know, from the added ingredients. We've got now this complication where 5 out of 34 of the vaccine candidates are dependent on squalene, which is most of which comes out of shark liver oil. There's the possibility that 500,000 deep water sharks may lose their lives in order to provide squalene.
And the law of unintended consequences.
Exactly. And, you know, if you're a vegetarian or vegan, are you being told that you're getting a derivative of shark liver oil being put into your vaccine? You know, there needs to be, you know, all the post-surveillance, post-marketing data needs to be put into the public domain. Mm-hmm. If you look at what happened with Pandemrix the last time around, that wasn't done. And yet there were some very significant cases of narcolepsy and no-fault vaccine.
Guillain-Barré syndrome and so on.
Exactly. Yeah. So transparency should be the order of the day. And I think we need to really get that onto the political agenda internationally. We're busy doing it over here. There's a lot of support for it. It needs to happen in the U.S. too, and really push for full transparency.
Well, by no means have we reached the threshold of acceptance of this, because a recent survey shows that just 13% of Americans said they'd be willing to try the vaccine immediately. A plurality of respondents said they plan to get it a few months after the vaccine first becomes available, but that's by no means a majority. So, in fact, the reluctance to accept a rushed vaccine is increasing, according to polls. So I think the public is savvy. You know, they're saying, let's not be the first kid on the block to be taking this.
The World Health Organization, as you're well aware, has declared vaccine hesitancy as one of the, you know, top 10 global health threats. And, of course, what I think what governments and the vaccine industry really need to take stock of is they are really, by lack of transparency, creating that hesitancy. Mm-hmm. You know, they are party. Unfortunately, the public who becomes hesitant is blamed. Yeah. But I think they have to accept some responsibility here.
You know, and there was a very interesting op-ed a couple of months ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, which by no means is anti-vaccine. But what they said is that in an effort to they are anticipating the development of the vaccine. And they said, but it is absolutely essential that, A, we don't have a vaccine mandate, because that's just going to freak people out. You know, that is the universal vaccination mandate, that it needs to be voluntary, number one. And number two, there needs to be enormous transparency, because you can't do a sell job on something when you're concealing data, when there's not complete data, because consumers need to know. I mean, after all, this is not the zombie apocalypse. This is going to be an elective situation where, you know, perhaps people in essential services, you know, on the front lines of healthcare, or, you know, in the military and so on, they may need to get the vaccine. First responders and so on and so on. That may be very important for people in, you know, perhaps teachers and so on. But for the general public at large, it still has to be discretionary for it to work.
Well, look, I fully agree. However, I'm not sure that the Californian government feels the same way. And right. And if you look at what's already in the pipeline in terms of vaccine passports and digital identity, things that were viewed a few months ago as conspiracy theory, they are now very, very clearly on the drawing board to be rolled out. And I think the way in which, you know, at one hand, you've got a government mandate. On the other hand, you've got the withdrawal of important privileges like your ability to travel. And I would suggest that the latter are highly likely to occur unless the people stand up in force and say enough is enough.
Indeed. All right. Well, more information can be obtained at the website of Alliance for Natural Health International, ANH-International.
Not dash, just ANHinternational.org.
Okay, great. You know, I always highly anticipate your writings. You know, you and your staff put an enormous amount of effort into and creatively share vital information about not just this, but other topics of great interest to our community. So I advise our listeners, our intelligent medicine listeners, to subscribe to the newsletter, follow ANH on social media. You're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, and just, you know, you can really stay abreast of what's happening in the natural health movement.
That's absolutely right. So ANHinternational.org, shortcut to our COVID area is covidzone.org, covidzone.org, where you'll find all our COVID-related material. But as Ron says, there's a lots more that isn't COVID-related. I think we're at a cusp, you know, a divide in terms of belief systems and what's going on. You know, people who really believe that a technological solution to disease and other problems is there, and others who have a deep respect for natural processes. And that divide is something that will unfold over the next year or so, I'm sure.
And, this current pandemic is certainly a call to action for people to pay attention to the very same risk factors that put them at risk for degenerative disease overall. They sometimes refer to the twin pandemics, COVID-19 and the even worse by an order of magnitude of dozens and scores, the death toll due to avoidable lifestyle risk factors through diet, exercise, stress reduction. Some of these things also apply in spades to COVID-19.
Correct.
All right. Great stuff. Thank you, Dr. Rob Kirk, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ron.
In the UK, near London. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Same to you. Thank you so much, Ron.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I'm inviting you to browse my online supplement dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. We stock only the highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements I prescribe to my patients and take myself. My specially curated professional-grade supplements are fulfilled via the FullScript network. FullScript is the safest and most convenient way to purchase my medical-grade supplements. Buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and offers world-class support. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free FullScript account. That's drhoffmanstore.com, drhoffmanstore.com.